Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing the creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The wealth inequality of this society can only be described as obscene. Over the last 6 months, since the virus really hit the United States, if you count to the middle of September, 643 richest Americans together, their wealth grew by $845 billion. This pandemic, which required over 60 million Americans to go file for unemployment compensation, they were without income, without security, using up whatever savings they might have scrounged together, borrowing and begging from relatives and friends. While that was going on, the richest people became much richer still. We are not going through this pandemic altogether. Some of us are paying dearly, and others of us are ripping us off.
That, in a nutshell, is our guest Dr. Richard Wolff's ultimate conclusion about capitalism. It's a systemic platform of exploitation of the many, which increasingly enriches only a few, leaving a wake of broad-based and increasing impoverishment through lifetimes of debt and struggle, exposing the vast majority to conditions that shouldn't have to be tolerated. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's colleague at the Public Banking Institute and your co-host. Rick Wolff is widely known as a renowned professor at prestigious universities. He's an author and an expert on economic systems. His latest book, entitled The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, a book that lays out the many ways that the capitalist system necessarily will consume an increasing number of people as it proceeds inevitably to move wealth to the top of the civic pyramid, claiming property and economic prospects by diminishing equity and hoarding capital within private fortresses of fortune. Now, that may sound like a bit of poetic license that ignores the benefits that capitalism has brought through its aggressive practices of profiteering from all sources, but Wolff points out that there are many other economic systems that would serve us far better and be fundamentally more democratic than capitalism. But as you'll hear in his interview with Ellen later in the program, capitalism has been enshrined by its powerful institutions, including our government, which, like capitalism itself, leaves power in the hands of the few. So today, we have a good long visit with Dr. Richard Wolff, which we think you'll really enjoy. Stay tuned. Now, Ellen and I have been looking at how public banking fits into a new economic framework in which the public's voice and power are more integral to the creation of policy and the distribution of our commonwealth through public banks, of course. One such way is through a new initiative brought forward by another of the Public Banking Institute's Board of Advisors, Dr. Robert Hockett, who has devised a plan currently under consideration at the congressional level for creation of a national infrastructure bank. An exciting idea that's not new to America. In fact, it's actually a replay of a highly successful series of decades in the 1900s begun in earnest by FDR, called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Let's talk with Ellen about it now. So, Ellen, America's infrastructure is known worldwide as being out of date, underdeveloped, ranks D's and F's and C minuses and a whole host of educational I should say, engineering studies that say America is like, you know, a 20th century sort of a country. And of course, we've had these proposals to build infrastructure. I think the Trump administration said they're going to put trillions of dollars into it. Well, we haven't seen it. Not only have we not seen it, no one knows where the money would come from, but now some new old ideas are coming forward. Let's talk about the National Infrastructure Bank and bring us up to speed on what that is looking like to you.
Okay, well, and we have more problems than infrastructure. We also have a huge unemployment. I've heard it called the Greatest Depression. So how are we going to get out of it? We can do the same thing that Roosevelt did. And that's what this latest infrastructure bank would do. It's following the Reconstruction Finance Corporation model, which is how Roosevelt funded rebuilding the entire country in the 1930s. So it's H.R. 6422. It was created by or introduced by Danny Davis, a Democratic representative, in March of this year. And it would create an infrastructure bank that could fund $4 trillion in infrastructure. And of course, infrastructure includes things like affordable housing that we desperately need. It would put millions of people back to work. And so it would get, you know, increase the tax base. But what interests me the most is the way it would be funded. It would be set up like Roosevelt's Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was not even technically a bank, but this one would be a bank. It would be an actual depository bank. So with a capitalization of $500 billion, they would be able to make loans, they calculate, up to $4 trillion in the same way that all banks do. So they make the loan and it's written as a deposit into the account of the borrower, and they would be making these at rock bottom interest rates. But then the question is, this is the only infrastructure bill that we've had that's called revenue neutral, meaning it won't cost us anything, no taxes, no debt, which is amazing. And the way they'll do it is to use existing federal and state and municipal securities. So they'll buy those securities with the credit, basically, and the securities will be are currently paying, like, maybe getting paid 2% or whatever. So that 2% would then be going to the infrastructure bank, and they will pay an additional 2% on top of that. Or whatever the current, I'm not sure what the current average interest rate is on federal debt. But anyway, the interest that's coming from the federal government would go to the bank. And on top of that, to attract people to sell these bonds, it would be largely the public sector, like Social Security or whatever. They have a lot of bonds. And it could be private investors. But these would all be what they would get in return. So they're not actually paying. They're getting it for preferred stock, which means preferred stock means it's not voting stock. So control is still left in the hands of the bank, which can then make prudent banking decisions. You know, they won't be influenced by their investors like everybody worries about if you have public-private partnership. The private always seems to win. They get all the benefits. But in this case, it would be the bank making prudent loan decisions. And so they can use it for all this infrastructure that we desperately need. We need, I guess, $4 trillion would do it to cover the deficit, because some of the infrastructure we need is already funded. And then it could also put a lot of people back to work. It would create tax money for, you know, I think they figure... with something like $80 billion profit per year. And then, you know, that would help with our taxes. And so it's a good deal all the way around. It would also help with climate, because one of our big problems, of course, is traffic congestion. And if you make high-speed rail and improve the roads, et cetera, you can cut way down on your emissions, the smog in the cities, which will, you know, help clean up the atmosphere and do achieve those goals. But what I particularly like is the funding mechanism. This is the same mechanism that Hamilton, it was the original Hamilton Bank. He took the state and the federal debt and made that the basis of the bank. That was the capitalization for the bank. And it worked. And with that, he got, the country was bankrupt and he got us out of bankruptcy and got us going again. And of course, he did the same thing where he used that capital, 10% capital, and created 10 times as much in the way of, I mean, today we call it digital money, but then it was paper money, or just paper that they paid off their debts, got out of debt, and managed to do a lot of building. And then Lincoln did the same thing. I mean, his was even better. I would go for the Lincoln model if we could talk Congress into it. Lincoln just issued the money. Congress can do that. It says in the Constitution, Congress shall coin money and regulate the value thereof. They could just print four $1 trillion coins, you know, stamp it on there, $1 trillion, put it in their bank account with the Fed and start spending money, which is the equivalent of what Lincoln did. And then, of course, so there were two, the first U.S. bank, the second U.S. bank, Lincoln's bank, and then Roosevelt's bank. So we've had four models of, you know, based on this same principle that you take, that you use debt, you capitalize, use the debt for capitalization, and then you create 10 times that sum in credit, which becomes actual money once you run it into the account of the borrower. And in this case, as with Roosevelt, the borrowers would be state and local governments and different public agencies that are going to build things. And how they would pay the loan back is fundamentally, principally, with proceeds of the things they've built. Like if they build a high-speed train, then the fees that they get for the train. And that's the same model that China has used, and they have done an amazing job of rebuilding things. And it was China that got us out of the Great Recession of 2008-2009 globally. You know, they were the engine where they just created all sorts of infrastructure, and they were making loans every which way. And where did they get the money? Just like all banks do. They just issued it as credit on their books, and they could do it because the government owns the banks, and so they could issue where they needed it, and it worked. And but that was actually we claim that as the American system. I know the Chinese actually printed money 1,000 years ago or so, you know, coin money. So it really was a Chinese system. I've been criticized for saying it was an American system, but compared to the British, you know, there was the British system which was private banking, and then the American system was basically public banking, or that the government would create the credit, turn the credit of the nation into actual money that we could build things with. And that's also what the Chinese do and why they're so successful.
So who runs the bank? Is this something that could be parsed out through into, presuming that it's the federal level of management oversight, is it also possible that regional banks or private banks could participate?
Oh yeah, if it were a state or local government that was the borrower, they could run that through their public bank. Of course, I think the other great solution to our current situation is to set up state and local public banks, which are depository banks, and therefore can borrow from the Fed at 0.25%, get this amazing interest rate that they are now making available to banks, but they are not allowing state and local governments to have access to. And that is their way of accessing it.
Yeah, it's a very sore point that just keeps getting sorer and sorer as the time goes on. And of course, they're withholding that credit and that infusion of money is going to complicate our long-term economic prospects terrifically. So we wish they would get on with it. And would this not then become also an institutional device for funding the Green New Deal? Is that also part of this portrayal?
I don't believe it's actually mentioned in the bill, but you could use it for any sort of infrastructure if Congress got going on that and actually started setting up the infrastructure, they could use that for the funding.
And the debt you're saying is being issued by the Treasury or by the Fed? Who's on point there?
The borrowing would be by whatever institution is doing the building. I mean, it's state and local governments that do most of our infrastructure now. So they would be the borrowers or their agencies that are assigned to whatever, like affordable housing or whatever agency was covering it. And then, I mean, that is something I'm not real clear on either. What if it was affordable housing? Who's going to pay back those loans? I suppose it's got to come out of state revenues eventually. But the deal would be that they would be making the lowest, they would be making these loans available at much lower interest rates than were otherwise available to state and local governments.
So we're actually looking at some pretty exciting prospects for a change in our financial management on the national level. It sounds like there is a fair amount of momentum behind this idea. It's overtime for us to get on with investing into our infrastructure. And it sounds like this has got some legs, as we say. I think in another program, Ellen, we will want to bring in our colleague Bob Hockett, who, as you know, was one of the really originators of this idea to bring back the Reconstruction Financing Corporation model for us to move forward. So hopefully we'll get some courage up in the next Congress to take on some new ideas like this. And of course, it can only lead to good things for public banks, because it certainly illustrates the main point of how this works. You know, we monetize our equity or debt, if you will. Monetize our credit. All right. Well, listen, we have a really great conversation coming up with Dr. Richard Wolf. And so we need to get on to that right now. Thanks so much, Ellen, and look forward to your upcoming article on this.
Oh, likewise. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Professor Wolf, it's great to be talking to you. I'm sure you need no introduction, but I've got one here, so I'm going to give it anyway. So, you're currently Professor of Economics at the New School University in New York City. And before that, you taught for 35 years at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You're co-founder of the nonprofit Democracy at Work. And we're delighted to have you on our advisory board at the Public Banking Institute. So that's all super. You've written several books, notably Understanding Marxism, Understanding Socialism. And your latest book just came out in September, called The Sickness is the System: When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, a very provocative title. So it seems to me, I mean, obviously capitalism is the target here, but it seems to me that we actually have two types of capitalism. The one that we all sort of relate to is what our founding fathers were thinking of, where it was, you might call it cottage capitalism, where every household was its own business. You had the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and like hundreds of farmers. My grandparents were farmers in Pennsylvania, so I know that, you know, anyway, I relate to all that. So that sort of capitalism was good. But what we have today, you might call corporate capitalism or big capitalism, where ironically the capitalists actually got richer during this crisis while everybody else got less rich. And I know there are different types of capitalism. So I just wonder what I've heard your form of, or your solution called radical democracy or workplace democracy. Anyway, can you explain what you're thinking of as the solution, and what was the villain here, and what's gone wrong with our original capitalist vision?
Yeah, well, let me start with where I agree with you, that what we've had is a very radical change from the early days of the United States as an independent country, even a bit before that, of a capitalism that had most people being very small, either self-employed or employing a handful of people, whether it be on the farm or the workshop or the small merchant house or whatever it was, to what we have today, which is a highly concentrated economy in which a tiny number of employers have become mammoth, enormous employers. Walmart has, you know, million, counts its employees in the millions, and the other Fortune 500 corporations count their employees in the tens or hundreds of thousands. Small business exists, but it has become marginal. Even put all together, it cannot begin to challenge what the top 2,000 or 3,000 companies together control this economy. And what they have done is narrow down in most industries the number of major companies to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 who get together formally or informally, set the prices, and draw into their hands enormous wealth. I mean, the wealth inequality of this society can only be described as obscene. And to give you just one statistic of many, over the last 6 months, that is, since the virus really hit the United States in the second half of March, if you count to the middle of September, so very close to our situation now, there's 643 richest Americans, 643 individuals together earned more, I shouldn't use the word earned, their wealth grew by $845 billion. So let me hammer home, this pandemic, which required over 60 million Americans to go file for unemployment compensation because they lost their jobs, meaning that they were without income, without security, using up whatever savings they might have scrounged together, borrowing and begging from relatives and friends. While that was going on, the richest people became much richer still. We are not going through this pandemic all together. We are not having to get together to get through this. Some of us are paying dearly, and others of us are ripping us off. If the 845 billion of extra wealth in the hands of those 643 richest Americans, and my data all come from the Wall Street Journal, so this is in the no dispute at all about it. If those $845 billion had been taxed away from those richest people, they would still be the 643 richest people in the United States. But we would have had $845 billion to help the American people actually get through what is a combination of a pandemic from the virus and a capitalist crash of huge proportions. We could have, for example, paid for reconfiguring all the schools and universities in this country so they would have been safe either to return to or to do remote learning. We didn't do that, which is why they have become hotspots for resurging coronavirus. We could have reconfigured the restaurants of this country so that at least half of them could have survived with larger spaces, better spacing, expensive ventilation, and all the other things that might have made them safe and made the cities less abandoned by the closure of all those shops. None of that was done. None of it. In the middle of the summer, when President Trump ordered the meatpacking workers from the Middle West to go back into those horribly dangerous butchery operations of the meatpackers, he demanded they go back to work. He made no demand on the employers as to what they would have to do to make the workplace safe. The unfairness, the injustice, the gross servitude to the people who make profits is really, even by American standards, grotesque. Well, let me turn then to what it meant to have a capitalism that works this way when we were hit by a virus. First, it's important to remember that viruses are part of nature. They've been around for millennia. They're part of life. Periodically, they come and they plague the human race, and that is as old as Methuselah. Back in 1918, we had a horrific pandemic here called the Spanish flu, killed 680,000 Americans. Terrible. We know exactly what that's all about. We've had more recently MERS, SARS, Ebola, a long list. We know that viruses are a problem. There is no excuse for being unprepared. But we were unprepared. That's why the following statistic really ought to shut the mouth of anyone who can imagine that this is anything other than a colossal failure. As we speak, Ellen, the United States has 4.5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of the world's COVID cases and the world's COVID deaths. We are a rich country. There is no excuse for the fact that we are doing so terribly badly, worse than dozens of other countries. The only thing more grotesque than our failure is the ability of the president to refer to what has happened as, quote unquote, we're doing great. No, we're not. How would you have prepared for such a virus? The answer is obvious, well known by all epidemiologists and health professionals. We needed to have on hand huge quantities of masks, gloves, ventilators, hospital beds, ICU units, and so on. We know how to produce them. We have the companies with the technology to do so. That should have been done. All that stuff should have been carefully, geographically distributed around the United States so as to be available where our population is dense to help people cope with a virus when it came. The private companies who could have done it did not do it. And I know why. It's not capitalism. It's not profitable to produce, let's say, masks by the millions, store them in a warehouse where you have to watch them and monitor them and clean them and maintain them and replace them if they get broken or wear out. And that's expensive. And you have to locate it around the country. And that's expensive. And then you'd have to wait for however many years before the next virus made them necessary. That's a much too risky proposition for a private profit-making business. So they didn't do it. Okay, that's the failure of capitalism to do what public health requires. What happens then is even more grotesque. The government, which could have come in and could have said honestly, okay, private capitalism stinks when it comes to preparing for viruses. So we're the government, we will compensate for the failure of private capitalism. And what does it mean? Very simple. We will now buy masks, gloves, ventilators, and the government will pay a nice price, making a profit for the companies who make them. And then the government, at taxpayer expense, will store it, monitor it, distribute it, replace it, clean it, all the things that have to be done, so we are prepared when the virus comes. If a government understood what I just said, they would have done it. But we have a government that is captured by the ideology that the private enterprise is the best way to get anything done. So they left it to the private enterprises, they didn't do it, and so we were unprepared when the coronavirus came.
I might ask, it seems to me that the other countries that have done better in terms of numbers, they didn't stockpile masks either.
No, some did, some didn't. And those who didn't had got their government into action immediately when that virus hit. And they're in a society where they think the government is an important player in shaping what is going on in this society. We live in a country in which we argue that the government is bad, is intrusive, is dangerous. It's a we versus they kind of split. So we immobilize our own government from helping us in the way that in South Korea or Taiwan or New Zealand or Australia, they don't think like that. And the government immediately came in to play the role. By the way, the government of the United States sometimes does. Let me give you a simple example. It is equally unprofitable for companies to make masks and gloves as it is for them to make missiles and bombs. You know, to make a missile and to stick it in a warehouse and to wait for the next war before you can sell it, no company would do that. Too risky, not profitable enough. So you know what happens? Exactly what we need. The government comes in, buys the bomb, buys the missile, buys the guns, and at government expense, stores them, trains people how to use them, maintains them, guards them, all the rest. What the government does for the military, it chose in our sick society not to do for public health. And that's a criticism around which there is no escape. And that's why we were unprepared, and that's why we have not contained this virus. Having said that, let me drive home another point that this book, this new book, makes. Economic crashes are part of capitalism. For the 300 years that we've had this system, it has crashed on average in every country on earth, on average, every 4 to 7 years. It's called in economics the business cycle, or the sequence of depressions, recessions, crashes, boom, bust. I mean, we have an immense vocabulary because this is with us. Everything has been tried in the history of capitalism to get rid of this instability, because the capitalists have always understood it's a very weak point of capitalism to be so unstable. In my classes at this point, I would turn to my students and I would say, if you lived with a roommate as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago. All right, so capitalism is that way. And this has made it very difficult for capitalists because they're constantly producing their own critics, the people who say, what the hell are we doing with an economic system that imposes this? It means that in every adult's lifetime, there are going to be a sequence of these downturns. Can I afford to buy a home and undertake mortgage payments if every 4 to 7 years, my job is at risk, my income is at risk? You know, people's educations are interrupted. I mean, it is a catastrophe to be in a system this unstable. And the way capitalism has handled this is, you know, in a conventional kind of way, partly by denial. And here's how the denial works. Well, we have monetary and fiscal policy. You know all about this, Ellen, because of your work. We have the Federal Reserve with all of its monetary tools, and we have the Treasury and so forth with its fiscal policy, and Keynes taught us how to do it. It's all lovely. It all looks real well. It fills the courses. I had to learn it as a PhD in economics, but it doesn't work. Bottom line, it doesn't work. It never has worked. Or to put it differently, when you thought it worked, it turns out to have been other things that made the economy turn up. Your great policy mix didn't do it. Another way that denial works is by blaming the crash of capitalism, the instability, on some external force. So for example, the crash in the spring of 2000 was called the dot-com crash. Why? Because the prices of certain stocks in the market, stocks with dot-com as part of their name, had very high, unusually high prices. So everyone said, ah, see, they were overpriced and they crashed. Well, I'm here to tell you that prices of selected stocks are always very high in the stock market. That's not unusual. You can't blame the crisis on the overpriced stocks, because I can give you 10 examples of overpriced stocks when there was no crash. So this is fakery, but we still call it the dot-com crash. 8 years later, we had the subprime mortgage crash. Why was it called that? Well, it turns out a lot of people borrowed money for mortgages they couldn't afford, they couldn't pay it back, and secondary derivative instruments were dependent on those mortgages, and they crashed with the inability of people to pay. Again, I can show you 10 examples in history when there were a spate of mortgage defaults that did not produce a crash. You're blaming the trigger, what provoked the crash. You're blaming for the crash itself. And now we have another one. We're going to call this one the COVID-19 crash. But again, notice we've had three crashes in the first 20 years of the 21st century. That works out to an average of, yep, every 7 years, just like the history of capitalism for 300 years. I want people, and that's what this book is largely about, to understand that as the NBER said when it dated this current crash, it begins in February of this year. That's the official crash beginning. The virus hadn't come here yet. It came the next month. And it's important in this little case to understand that the virus didn't cause the crash. The crash is built into this system. And it has always been a wise counsel of people who understand capitalism to warn everyone. It's bad enough when capitalism goes through its fundamental, incorrigible instability every 4 to 7 years. But watch out. If one of those downturns should coincide with a natural disaster or with a political disaster, then the ability to cope will be compromised and the consequences of the crash will be way, way worse. That warning we are now living through. Last point. I'm a student of history. I used to teach economic history at the university where I taught, at Yale, at the UMass, and so on. And one of the chapters, an important chapter of modern European history, is called the bubonic plague or the Black Death. Back in the 13th and 14th centuries, Europe was overwhelmed by a viral pandemic, was carried by fleas who lived on rats who invaded everybody's home. The result was hundreds of millions of people died. Roughly a third of the entire European continent perished. It was also the beginning of the end of feudalism. All the lords that counted on the serfs to deliver the rentals, the serfs were dead. They didn't deliver anything. The landlords were suddenly without any income. They couldn't survive. They began to die off. The system could not function. Yeah, it sort of stumbled back. It never recovered. conscious of that, one ought to wonder whether the disruption of world trade, of domestic economics, of the college educations of the American young people, all the horrific consequences, the literal tsunami of home evictions that are on schedule to begin now and especially at the 31st of December when the so-called moratorium expires. You're looking at a society already torn apart by the inequality building up of capitalism, now made worse by the obscenity of the rich getting richer over this pandemic. The conditions of sustainability in a country that used to pride itself by saying, we are all middle class. We don't have aristocrats. We don't have desperately poor. Oh, yes, we do. And more of them every day. Super rich at the 1% and a desperate mass of people at the other end. And this is a story that history teaches us does not end well.
Well, I totally agree with you on how screwed up our system is, but a big question that I always get is how do we get from here to there? What's the transition mechanism?
Well, I think the first thing is you have to face some things that we're not used to. I don't think our problems are any more at the level, gee, elect this person, not that one, or change this law, not that one, or get rid of that regulation, or add another. We're beyond that. We've been there, we've tried that. That has not solved our problem. We have to dig deeper. We did learn lessons from the Great Depression of the 1930s, but the notion that the lessons we learned would prevent us from being in that situation again, that is not a sustainable argument anymore. We're in that situation now. We weren't able to learn the lessons or apply them that would prevent it. So I think we need basic change. So here's what I would offer, and this is what I answer to people when they ask me the question that they're also asking you. I locate one of the key roots of our problems in the way we have organized enterprises, factories, offices, stores. We take it for granted, and we shouldn't, that they are organized with a tiny group of people at the top who make all the decisions, the owner of the business, or if it's a corporation, the board of directors, or the major shareholders, who are tiny groups of people, tiny minorities. They make all the decisions. They decide what is going to be produced in the way of a good or a service, what technology is going to be used, where all of this is going to be done, and then the really big one, they decide what is done with the output, with the goods or services that have been produced by everybody's input and cooperation to produce the output. So we allow a tiny group of people to make these absolutely fundamental economic decisions. The rest of us, the vast majority, who are employees rather than employers, we live with the decision, including losing our job, losing our income, having to work in unsafe, unlivable conditions, and all the rest. So for me, I deduce that if you have a tiny group of people running the businesses in this country, then we really have no basis to be surprised that they give the bulk of the income to themselves. I mean, what would you expect? Them to be very noble, have gone to church, been overwhelmed by what the minister told them, and so give it all away? They don't do that. They keep it for themselves. In a big corporation, they give themselves spectacular executive packages. They pay out wonderful dividends to their shareholders. We shouldn't be surprised. Punchline, if you want the economy to serve the people, you've got to put the people in charge. You can't have every business governed by a tiny minority at the top. They would have to be governed basically democratically. That is, everybody in the business, together, one person, one vote, they decide democratically what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the fruits of their collective labor. The democratization of the enterprise seems to me a basic change that can reorganize how this economy works, and particularly for whom it works. Last point. I know this is a bit of a heavy lift, or it's a lot to ask, or it's grandiose. I understand all of that. But I would like to just remind everyone, for a long time in human history, we had kings, you know, or queens, or people at the top, and when they went by in a coach, we all bent over or doffed our hat or got down on a knee, and we all accepted that that's the king, he or the queen make all the decisions, we are the subjects of the king, and we do what the king dictates. And we're grateful to the king because we can't imagine how we would get through life without someone in charge, and the king is him. At a certain point, the human race decided, except for a few countries that keep kings and queens as decorations, they decided this was outrageous. Many societies got rid of their kings in a rather blunt and scary way. I won't go into that. But we got rid of monarchy, and we weren't regretful about it. The American Revolution said, we're not going to allow King George III to be the ruler of this country anymore. And we will go and make a violent revolution, not just to be independent of England. We didn't replace King George with King George Washington. We said, no more kings. Well, you know something? The irony is we don't have kings in politics, but we still have them inside the enterprise. The CEO is a king. He decides pretty much everything. A tiny handful of his associates on the board of directors or among the major shareholders together advise the king. We've allowed kingdoms to survive inside our enterprises, and now we are paying the price. So my suggestion, my advice, my proposal, let's begin to do something, which, by the way, already exists all over the world, including the United States. Let's change the way we've organized business in this country, bottom up, not from the top, not expecting the state to do things for us, but to start at the bottom and say, let's reorganize how human beings interact with one another in the workplace. And remembering that 5 out of 7 days, adults go to work. They spend the best hours of their day in the workplace, 5 out of 7 days. If we believe in democracy, it should have been installed there from the get-go. But we didn't. We exempted the workplace, left the king in charge, left the monarchy in place. That has to go. That's why, in fact, you know, I don't mind saying it, that my absolute support for the notion of public banking goes beyond taking that away, that enormous power of money and monetary control and financial capability, take it away from profit-making private enterprise where it should never have been, and make it a public resource, you know, like the air and the water and all the other things we need together. I would only add to that, I would also like to see it be a cooperative workplace situation where the workers in the bank, together with the community that the bank serves, together make those decisions democratically without an intervention of private enterprise looking to make a private buck out of what is a public service.
Yeah, that's great. Of course, I totally agree with that. I mean, we do, it seems to me right now, we need government, we need the government's deep pocket in order to fix where we are right now. We've got all these little businesses that are dead. And as you point out, many, many unemployed. So how are we going to bring them back? We've got to just shell some money out into the economy, the real economy, not the financialized one that, you know, the dot-com economy.
Right, and, but the problem is, we go back to the beginning of your first point. If you've allowed, 2,000 corporations to become monumentally wealthy, multinational, conglomerate, mammoth corporations, they understand what you just said. They understand that they are a minority of the businesses, that the vast majority of businesses are medium and small. Just like they understand that the working class is huge and they as an employer class is small. And because they understand what that means, they've bought the political system. You're not going to get the government to do what you describe, even though that's what we need and that's what might get us out of the situation. But that's not going to happen because they don't want that. It's a great risk for them that a government might in fact be responsive to the mass of people, because it is highly unlikely that the mass of people in this country, even right now, would endorse that the richest 643 people became wildly richer while 60 million of their fellow citizens had no job. I mean, no human community that I'm aware of is so depraved as to do what we take for granted as the consequence of our capitalist system.
Well, we are sort of stuck, it seems to me, in terms of what we can do, except talk. I mean, we have to re-educate people so they see what the problem is here and rely on that younger generation that really has picked up the flag of socialism. As you pointed out before, it used to be sort of a unpatriotic word, but now the young people are, all for it, all behind it, because they're the class that's getting the shaft here.
Absolutely. They can't go to school. The jobs that they have to look forward to are unsustainable. The debts they have to incur to even get those jobs mean that they'll never be out of debt. We now have an entire generation of people over 60 still paying off their college debts. I mean, the signs of a breakdown in our society, of a capitalism in decline, are everywhere. And no matter how strong the denial, how much impotent rage a Mr. Trump can articulate every day on the media, he can't change any of this. He can only distract and deny, say that we're doing great against a pandemic that we're not doing great at, and that we're going to punish China when the victor in the struggle between the United States and China has been China for the last 25 years. And you can huff and puff all you want. You don't change the reality on the ground, which will eventually come and bite you in the rear end, which is what everybody else who's tried to play the game this way has had to learn. Anyway, the book I wrote, the title, The Sickness is the System, was really to focus people that the real illness we have to cure is this capitalism. Whether you call it socialism or not, I really don't care. The system is dying, and we either change it or it's going to take us down with it. All right.
Thank you for all your work. You're out there doing a lot of re-education, which is
great. I take my hat off to you. I have learned, listen, it's so funny, I went to Harvard and Stanford and Yale. I'm like a poster boy for elite education. And in those universities, I studied the monetary system of the United States and the Federal Reserve. My teachers, because of these fancy universities, were people who advised the Federal Reserve Board in Washington or were on the Council of Economic Advisors. And I want your audience to know, I've learned more about the monetary system of the United States, money, the Fed, reading your articles over the years than I learned in those fancy universities. Your critical perspective, really, and I urge people to read the stuff that you guys do, particularly your own writings. You'll get a real education and you'll understand what's going on much better than if you live only in the world of the mainstream financial press.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind. I mean, my degree is in law, so I can write about these things. You know, I mean, I can see it from the point of view of, at one time I was a housewife, you know, from the point of view of an ordinary person who's good at research. That was always my forte, was research and writing. That's why I went into law, because what else could you do with an English degree? And so I was able to see things and say things that people that were employed in the economics business probably can't say today without jeopardizing their jobs. I mean, you can, which is great.
Yeah, they can, but many of them don't get it. They're so lost in the details, in the grandiose proposals, in the promises of what they're going to be able to do to control the economy, that they long ago lost their critical edge. Whereas when you write your articles, you go right in and ask the difficult question and then give us an understandable, well-crafted sentence that explains it. And you go away and you have a sense, wow, now I see the linkage between these things. I am in your debt. You know, I'm here I am with my big PhD in economics. But as I say, and I mean it very seriously, I've learned more about the reality of the monetary system in this country from your writings than I have from anything that was taught to me in these fancy universities.
Oh, thank you. And we're so privileged to have you on our advisory board. That's great. And your insights are great. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. And I hope that we have another chance to talk again soon.
Okay. I'd love that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
Bye.
You.
I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Wolff, whose new book is The Sickness in the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. It's currently available and can be ordered at democracyatwork.info. We want to thank Dr. Wolff for his appearing in this interview and for being on the advisory board of the Public Banking Institute.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.